You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And this week we're going to be looking at the 1973 Canadian TV series, The Star Lost. And specifically, we're going to be looking at the pilot episode, which is entitled Voyage to Discovery, something like that. Voyage of Discovery.
Yes.
So, Ben, this is an oldie. 73 is really pushing the boundaries of my ability to watch a TV show when it originally aired.
I thought you were going to say it was pushing the boundaries of good sci-fi taste.
It may be pushing those boundaries as well. It's certainly pushing some boundaries, but it's a little bit old. I never saw this show when it aired. And in fact, I never saw this show in syndication because it wasn't syndicated much. And I hadn't seen it until I was given it as a present on DVD here recently.
Wow. So you acquired this rather recently then.
Very recent. I mean, I knew about The Star Lost from Starlog magazine, which I used to read as a child every month, hell or high water kind of thing. And so I knew about it, and I knew Douglas Trumbull and Harlan Ellison had been part of it. And it seemed like a fascinating concept, but I had not seen the show at all. So it's truly a voyage of discovery for me. How about you?
The show, when it came to my part of the world, in California, I really can't remember exactly what year it was. I don't think it was 73. I think it was a little later than that we started seeing it in syndication where I was living. But I watched it religiously when it was on. But then this goes back to what I was saying regarding Man from Atlantis last week, and that is there was a drought of science fiction, whether it be good or bad, and I was prepared to watch anything that was even remotely science fiction related. So,
well, this is remotely science fiction related.
Very remote. It's very remote. So when it was on, yeah, I watched it a lot. I remember loving it, but then again, I was a child at the time, you know. So, wiser. I have a wiser sense now.
Well, I have to say, one of the things that I liked about it, and I won't say I liked it. I'm going to say that I am very meh about this particular show. But one of the things that I did like was the premise. The premise of this program is that there is this giant generational starship, the Earthship Ark, carrying the last survivors of the planet Earth, sealed in biospheres, unknown to one another, and a problem on the ship has caused it to be wandering for 500 years without crew, off course, barreling, figuratively speaking, towards its destruction in a collision with a star. And our three heroes come out of this backwards, rural, almost Amish community, and they are the only people that know about this, and so they try to get the knowledge, find people, whatever it takes, to save the lives of the originally 3 million people who had been on board the ship. So that, you know, nice story. I seem to recall, if I'm not mistaken, it was Heinlein. Was it Heinlein's? Orphans of the Sky. I think that was that story, too, and I suspect it's been others. But it's an interesting idea, and I don't poo-poo that as the basic concept. I think it's has potential. we've got three main characters who I like to call Mustache, Long Hair, and Drip. Keir Dulay of Dave Bowman 2001 fame is Mustache, a sincere, questioning young man who didn't get along well with his Amish society because he kept asking questions. And his distinctive characteristic is a great big mustache and a complete lack of emotion, acting, or much motivation in a character.
And how is that different from other roles that he's ever played?
I don't know. You know, I've only ever seen him as Dave Bowman. I don't think I've ever
That's
seen him
true.
In anything else.
I did see him in a more recent film, but it was the same. It was he was a tree.
I would like to think that he's not an incompetent actor. I would not want to put that on people, but it really comes off poorly in this program. And I think, whereas I will call him Mustache, I believe his name was Devin in this.
Yes.
Devin. And then there's Longhair, who is the village blacksmith. He was betrothed to Mary Drip, the girl. And the fact is that Drip and... I called him Devin. Oh, it's going to be hard. Drip and Mustache love each other, but the computer creator voice tells them that they are not genetically suitable and that Drip and Longhair have to get married. And Longhair is distinguished by being a big guy, a blacksmith, and he is competing for most wooden acting with Mustache on that. But he has longer hair.
Oh, and it's feathered, too. It's beautifully styled.
Is it? I just thought it was a bad haircut. But all right,
consider the times.
I don't see those things. It's not in my nature. And then finally, Drip, which I call her Drip. I wanted to call her Plain Jane because she's kind of totally disinteresting. But really, I know from later episodes that she's really a wet blanket. But that's just too long. So Drip is it. Her name is. Rachel. And she really doesn't bring anything to it at all. I mean, if I wanted to say that Mustache and Longhair didn't bring anything to the table, she brings less, if that's possible.
She takes away.
she is negative on this. So we've started off with three not at all interesting main characters.
You forgot to give the real name of Longhair.
Oh yes, it's Garth. Garth, yes. Garth, Rachel, and Devin. Let's keep that straight. Devin is Mustache, Garth is Longhair, Drip is Rachel. There's a quiz later, and here's the tricky part. Garth, Devin, and Rachel all have long hair. So, it's just that Garth's is longer.
And so he wins.
And he wins. And it's almost as long
as Drip's.
As Devin's mustache. Which is quite a relic from the 70s. I must say. What did you think about the premise and the setup, if you will?
I thought the premise initially was somewhat interesting. I was very curious as to how much of Harlan's initial stories had been altered. I did a little bit of reading on this, and it turned out that he had been approached to create a six-part, I guess you could call it almost like a mini-series, mm-hmm. but due to an impending strike here in the U.S., at Hollywood, they agreed to do the show completely up in Canada with the total Canadian crew.
Oh, it's an even bigger mess than that. It was originally pitched at him that it was a co-production between 20th Century Fox and like either the BBC or British backers. And so they thought that Lou Grade was going to be, and it was going to be filmed over there in their studios and taken care of as a British production, much the same way as programs like UFO Space 1999 were done. And then that fell through because 20th Century Fox didn't...
No, they didn't pick up. They didn't pick it up.
They didn't pick it up as a full package, and it was rejected. It was rejected, I guess, by the BBC, then it was rejected by whoever else. And so it fell back to just 20th Century Fox. And then the strike kicked in, and so they moved it all to Canada for production. And Canada in 1973 did not have the talent or the technology to achieve this.
I mean, they were less than the BBC was at that time.
Right. This program is entirely shot on videotape, and it looks far worse. I mean, it is color videotape, but it is far worse than even going back another 5-10 years in Doctor Who history, back into the 60s. It's not well done at all.
No.
There were problems with that, too. I mean, that was a bit of a nightmare story, in that Douglas Trumbull, from special effects for 2001, Silent Running, was going to do this program, and he backed out. But he was also going to use some new technology called the Magicam, I believe it was.
Yes.
And that was supposed to simultaneously mirror the movements of a master camera with a slave camera. And the master camera would be on the people in a blue screen, and the slave camera would be scaled down and looking at a miniature. So they would be getting a virtual set facility. More sophisticated than just blue screen, because camera motions would be synced and they'd be able to make it look like they were interacting more with these fake sets. But that equipment didn't work, and they had to fall back to standard green screen or blue screen back in those days. And they couldn't use sets because their studios were too small to build the sets, so they had to go with the blue screen wall, and they look bad, really bad.
Key insert generally tends to look pretty poor on videotape.
Yes, and of course back then there were a lot more problems with lighting, and you didn't have computers to clean it up after the fact or do edging, or so it was poor. What we failed to mention, and we should have, is that it was written by the great Harlan Ellison, and this was kind of his dream pitch. They brought him in to do one show, and he didn't like it, and they said, well, what would you do? And he pitched this idea to them, and they said, fantastic, great, let's do it. But by the time it reached the end, it's credited as created by Cordwainer Burt, which is the fake name, or the writing credit name that Harlan Ellison uses when, quote, he wants to give the bird to the producers who ruined his ideas. That's where the name is for, and what it is,
and as it stands, he only wrote one episode, and that was the pilot,
and that was supposedly significantly rewritten.
Yes, in fact, I just read a treatment moments before we started recording that kind of gives a slightly different spin as to how the pilot was supposed to be. And it starts off not too dissimilar in terms of premise. I mean, you've got this big ship where something breaks down on the steering mechanism and the ship just veers off course. And everybody in their individual all the communities in their individual biospheres, which we will get to later, they forget that they're on this big ship. They have no idea because it's been hundreds of years. And an Amish child triggers the door, and it opens, and he finds his way into the hallway and then realizes that it connects to these other communities. And when he gets back to his Amish community, he doesn't even know how to describe it because he has nothing to compare it to. He has no basis of reference. And that's pretty much how it starts. He ends up on this personal mission to, shall we say, awaken each community of this ship to let them know what is in reality going on. And I thought, well, that sounds like it has a much stronger potential. But then as you had pointed out, other people got involved, even though Harlan had been writing this Bible, which some very small ideas had been used in later episodes by Canadian writers. The basic premise was totally retooled into what we see now.
Well, that's
it just irritated Harlan so much. Especially, you know, there was then you had to deal with like there were budget cuts and God knows what else, and he just finally said, I'm done.
It's interesting. I wasn't necessarily going to get into what was the difference between the pilot and what ended up until we actually talk about what happened in the pilot, but Harlan did quit, and his story was quote-unquote significantly rewritten, and he retained the rights to the original script, and he submitted that script and won in 1974 the Writers Guild Best Teleplay for an episodic dramatic series. So I mean that's your an extra finger thrown up at the guys who butchered your show, is that he got his original script, and then that was later novelized with his approval. And that's available. I don't think it's in print, but you could find it. But weird coincidence. I was doing the same research probably that you were today, and I discovered that, and by the way, the original pilot was called Phoenix Without Ashes.
Right. And well, later changed to Voyage of Discovery.
It is being currently novelized as a comic book by IDW.
You're kidding.
The first two issues are out. The second one came out last week. I ran down to our favorite comic book store, Stalking Moon, and visited David, who's been on our podcast before, and I managed to get the first two, and I'm waving them at the camera right now. I've read them, and so far, they're very, very similar to the pilot as aired. In fact, I've got very few differential points yet. So I'm hoping to see the rest of the series here in the next few months and find out what was so great about it compared to the one that we saw.
Interesting.
So let's summarize the plot of the first episode. Devin, or Mustache, as he prefers to be called, is a naughty boy in his firebrand, religious, Amish community. He's an orphan. He has no trade because he doesn't have parents to teach him a trade. He's a ward of the elders, which are the people that run the community. And he is in love with Drip, or Rachel, and she has been promised to long hair, Garth. And he doesn't like that. And he's been banished to the wilderness for a few days to purge his thoughts. But he comes back, and he's still the same guy. He's still asking questions. Where does the water come from? How does the sun move in the sky?
Right.
Where does the waste go when you drop it down the loo?
The loo.
Yeah. And that is, of course, blasphemy. And the creator speaks to them through these communication devices, and it explains that, you know, genetically that's not the right match, and you'd better toe the line. And so he's publicly humiliated and sent on his way. And later, he spies on the elders. And he finds out that it's all a fake. That they record the messages from the creator. And then have the computer translate what they say into machine speak. And then they play the cassette tapes back to tell everyone what they do. It's a complete and utter fraud. And so this prompts him to get in trouble. Oh, wait a minute. Am I missing part here? Yes.
Prompts no, you're doing good.
He gets out and he meets up with Gandalf, who is sitting next to a door that says, "Beware, death ye lies beyond," or something like that. And he's not really Gandalf. I think his name's Abraham.
Yes.
He's actually a good guy. He's an old guy who also questions things, but he's considered a fool. And he lets Devon out the door because he's got keys. And Devon goes out and finds that the ship is...
A ship.
A ship. And that there are domes on it, and he encounters possibly the second most annoying computer in the history of television. The first being Crichton from second season of Buck Rogers. But the information computers on the Earthship Ark are truly... what would be the word for it? I don't even know. It's so bad, it's not just bad. It needs its own word for it. And he gets the knowledge that the ship's on a collision course, that it is a ship, although he doesn't really understand that concept. And so he goes back to try to tell everyone. And he's captured, he's locked up, he's sentenced to death. And he and Rachel escape and leave because they're in love. And Garth hunts them down because he's been humiliated, even though he's apparently their friend in the grand scheme of the little community. And they find that the bridge, they get to the bridge, and it's everyone's dead, and that's pretty much it.
That's it.
Yeah, that was the whole story. But that's the beginning of their adventure. What did you think of ignoring the acting of our heroes, who are just appalling? What about the rest of it?
The one thing that's really important to know is that this pilot, I would say, a good deal of it is really about Devon rebelling. Mustache.
Yeah,
rebelling against the Amish community and the elders. And the premise is laughable, because here he is. He's asking about, where does the water come from?
Where does the poo go?
Yeah, where's the? How does the sun cross the sky? Yet, it's almost being treated like superstition, and yet there is evidence of advanced technology in some form or another all around them, really kind of it was very, very puzzling for me. There were these torches, which were electronic in nature. You have the computer, which to them should seem like magic. And yet they're questioning things like the sun, where the source of water, the walls are made of a material that is completely outside their understanding. So there was this, the community as it was presented was something of a paradox. It was a contradiction amongst themselves. It was very, very, it was very distracting for me. And knowing that is when you look at the Amish community, anything that is modern or anything that is outside the life that they strive to lead, anything that strays from that is akin to evil. Yet it's all around them anyway.
It's an interesting point. I'm not sure that these are supposed to be specifically the Amish. They are Amish-like with the beards and the black and the hat. But here's my question for you. This is my observation. I recorded the little timeline that the that you can get out of the story. That in the year 2285. An accident of quote unquote galactic proportions destroys the Earth.
Yeah, we'll get to that part later.
Yeah, that's.
I want to talk about that later.
What does that mean? But anyway,
we'll talk about that later.
So then they're traveling for 100 years to the year 2385, and then there is an unknown accident, and unfortunately, the tape that includes the information as to what the accident was is missing. So we don't know what that is, but then the ship is locked on a collision course, the crew is dead, and significantly, there were 3 million people put in these biospheres, and they were sealed off from one another so that their ethnicity or their culture would retain its characteristics.
Its purity.
During the extremely long voyage, and so they're really unaware. But you know that the people who went in. Oh, and then 500 years have passed, and, or 405 years have passed since the accident. So it's been 505 years since the ship launched from Earth. Now, my first thought is, A, whoever went in there, do you think that they went in Amish? Or do you think that that is the result of 500 years of degradation? The second thing is, if they did go in there Amish, then they most certainly, and I'm using Amish in the generic black hat, big beard, religious farmer mindset. If they did go in that way, they obviously didn't have any problem with it being technology, and they obviously knew that they were on a spaceship.
Right.
And that is 505 years in which they had no catastrophes, and everything's just working fine for them. I mean, they're totally isolated from this problem. Is that enough time for them to have lost all the knowledge of that and become the more superstitious primitives that they are? Is that enough time? I don't think it is.
No.
I mean, yeah, we fell pretty fast after the Roman Empire went down and the Middle Ages came in. But still, it just seemed... It seems a little unconvincing to me.
Well, especially when you have the elders be fully aware of what some of this technology is and how it works. I mean, clearly, the leader of the community, I mean, he was using it for his own nefarious purposes. I mean, whatever his ends were, we're not entirely sure.
And whatever he knows is not sure. I mean, he may very well know the full story. I mean, not the accident, but the full thing about them being put in. And it may just have been a power grab by somebody.
It's very possible. And I kind of wonder if this whole part – I mean, since you're reading the comic book from
you make it sound so bad. It's a graphic novel.
I'm sorry, graphic novel.
That sounds more like I don't have to be five. No.
Hey, I like comic books. I'm not embarrassed. But if the graphic novel is indeed an adaptation of the teleplay that Harlan had written prior to its disastrous rewrite, I kind of wonder, was Harlan making a statement about the absurdity of organized religion?
Oh, Harlan Olson?
Yeah.
I can't imagine he would make a statement. He seems like such an uncontroversial and...
he's such a nice man.
A nice man, yeah. Yes, I don't know. And I kind of wonder if... You know, really things are left, in my opinion, hanging. Because the three of them get out.
And they never go back.
And as far as I know, they never go back. And I'm wondering if someday there'd be a Return to Cypress Corners episode where they would go back to the dome and... try to cause more trouble.
Who knows?
And maybe that the story would have fleshed itself out as to what the elders knew.
If the show had been allowed to go the course and completely flesh itself out totally as Harlan had originally envisioned, I would say there's a strong possibility that they would have ended back up at Cypress Corners as part of the resolution of the entire story, sort of a full circle kind of thing.
Where they show up beaten and discouraged by all the resistance they've met in the domes, and they go back to Cypress Corner with a massive nuclear device and destroy the whole ship.
That's it, yeah. No,
that'd be the modern remake.
Yeah, that'd be the modern remake, yes. No, but maybe to go back and find out that maybe somebody there actually knows something that could help. You know, Abraham was a rather interesting fellow. The fact that he was in possession of these keys, he knew that door was a way out. I mean, I assume that he probably went out there himself at one point.
I think he said he'd never had the courage to do it.
That's right. That's right. He did say he'd never had the courage to go out, but he knew what it was. So I kind of wonder, maybe somewhere deep in Cypress Corners, the solution was there. And it became necessary to go back in order to save the day, shall we say.
That would be cliche.
Yeah, it would be horribly cliche. So yeah, forget that. Harlan would never do anything like that.
No, he would never write a cliche. Anyway, so Harlan Ellison got out before the show started. Doug Trumbull got out before the show started. They had a science consultant, guy you
Ben
may have
Bova.
Heard of, Ben Bova. He basically quit, but they
his
kept...
His name is attached. They kept his name because he didn't have the same contract that Harlan
had. That's right. And nor did Doug Trumbull. His name's on there somewhere as well.
Well, Harlan was clever enough.
Harlan's been burned before, I think. That
yeah, Harlan was burned badly by a certain other great bird. Oops. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I speaking out of turn?
And Ben Bova apparently was there as a science consultant, and to his frustration, they just never listened to him. And in fact, he wrote a book called The Star-Crossed.
Right.
Which is a story of a science fiction writer contracted to be a scientific consultant on a sci-fi series.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. I'd like to read it. I'm actually... Ben Bova is a fascinating character.
I like Ben Bova far more than
I do Harlan Ellison. And Harlan Ellison is you have to grant him it, if nothing else, he's
Harlan's
one of the greats.
A brilliant writer.
But I like Ben Bova's writing better, usually. It's a little less
pretentious.
It's a little more hard sci-fi as well. It's more grounded.
Harlan, for all his good writing, there's an air of pretentiousness in what he writes, or in the manner in which he writes.
Most people would call that arrogance, yes.
Yeah.
You have any other things you want to mention on this show before we wrap it up?
Well, one of the things that really just had me kind of... I had to stop and think about it for a second. And I guess the reason I noticed it is because the acting in this scene was just so god-awful bad. It's when... Our three heroes make it to the bridge, and they're seeing out into space. This is a concept that is foreign to them. The only one who knows even anything remotely about this is Devon, and that's from his dialogue with the second worst computer in the universe a little bit earlier in the episode. May I be of assistance?
Assistance? Yes, he is that.
I'll talk about the computer in a minute. So you've got our three heroes looking out into space. Now, given the superstitious nature that is implied in the story in this pseudo-Amish-like community, I find it a little unrealistic that they would look out with wonder into what they're saying. I mean,
they're saying that they would be looking out with wet pants.
Yes, pretty much. They would have lost all their bodily fluids by this point.
I think they would have lost them in those bounce tubes before they ever got there.
That too. But and the only one who showed any kind of possible, close to realistic response was Garth. At one point, after looking out the window for the first time, he turns to Devin and says, "Let's go back." And Devin's like, "No, we can't go back." I mean, Devin's looking like he's on some sort of an acid trip now.
He probably was, considering the year and such. But I think maybe he was getting some sort of, he's finally getting that religious zeal that he didn't get from his Amish community. He's got it with that star that they're going to crash into.
Yeah, but it's still, this is more information than he should be able to process. I mean, he's gone through a lot in a very, very short period of time. I mean, his little world has just become infinitely larger. And Longhair is, I mean, he's a stone the entire time. And Drip, I don't even want to describe the expression that she had on her face.
They should have had far more culture shock. I think that would be the appropriate
right.
The appropriate word.
It was completely unbelievable. So I found that to be frustrating, to say the least. The other thing that really had me somewhat puzzled is this catastrophe that happened on Earth of galactic proportions.
Yes.
Our second worst computer tells Mustache that as a result of this galactic catastrophe, the leading scientists all came together and were able to build this ark to preserve selected life. Now, my question is this. If this catastrophe was that bad, how on earth did they come up with the resources to build something of that enormous size?
Taxation.
Yeah.
Taxation. They had to tax rich people, and then they weren't able to provide jobs for poor people and probably wrecked the economy of the dying planet. Or perhaps they realized that since the planet was going to be blown up, they could throw everything at it.
Well, we really don't know. We're kind of led to believe that the catastrophe had happened. And, I mean, that's what I was getting out of it. The catastrophe of galactic proportions has occurred. And this wasn't a case of running away because of an impending doom, but that the doom had already happened.
Yes, I'm sure the Earth has already been destroyed. My question is, what, and this is obviously just where they ignored Ben Bova, I assume, because galactic proportions implies that the galaxy is affected. But we can tell from the speed of this ship and the length of time it's been traveling to get to this star that they don't have light speed. And if they don't have light speed and they've been traveling 505 years, it was no catastrophe of galactic proportions.
No.
I mean, they've got to still be inside the Milky Way galaxy on their way to another star in the Milky Way galaxy.
And I can't believe that the computer would actually use, I mean, okay, so let me get to the computer. Yeah, let me get to the computer now. I found the computer to be a laugh. I mean, he's really laughable. He did speak in a rather halting manner, but it's when I hear him speak, he reminds me of these automated operators that you hear when you're on the phone, when you're on hold or something, and you have some person who has recorded a whole bunch of words, a whole bunch of numbers, and there's some computer that is based on whatever need or whatever the caller is doing, it would stitch these things together. I kind of got that same impression with this computer. It was just accessing all sorts of random bits of memory just so that I could try to put together some type of a structured sentence to give to Mustache, and it was laughable.
It's weird how he takes his breaths, and I'm going to insert a clip right here so you can hear it.
This is a continuation of the history of planet Earth from Cylinder 4-1.
What is planet Earth?
The home world. Geophysical and astronomical data may be obtained from Cylinders 1 through 6. Familiarize yourself with that subject matter in a later session. Now you need only know that life for us began on a cold body in the Milky Way, approximately 8,000 miles in diameter. In the year AD 2285, a catastrophe of galactic proportions threatened all Earth life with extinction.
What catastrophe?
Select Cylinder 4-1.
Four-one is not here.
Not programmed to synopsize previous cylinders.
See what we mean? Really bad.
Terrible.
Really terrible bad. And it's interesting
it's a joke.
That they managed to get a simulated person. They've overcome the problem of creating a person that can interact with the operator, with yes, it sounds like a robotic operator, but it's not just the voice. It's actually an image.
It's a face on a screen.
It's a face on a screen that talks and has expressions and can point at things.
And whenever he's trying to access some bit of memory, his eyes flutter.
Yes, he's like it's as if it's a computer generated representation rather than a recording. And so they've managed to achieve the ability to take the enormous amount of information and processing power that it would take to do that, but they haven't managed to make tapes of information big enough to hold any more than about 6 paragraphs worth of information.
Exactly.
So they've mastered the computer power, but not storage technology, which is probably exactly the opposite of what happened in real life.
Mm-hmm. Especially when we look at it today. I mean, granted, I have to keep telling myself, okay, this show was 1973, so...
And Canadian.
Canadian.
They were...
So yeah. it was written with that kind of sensibility, with... And we're right in that they completely ignored everything that Ben Bova had to say. I'd be fascinated to know what Ben Bova had possibly... suggested.
Nuke it from orbit. It's the only way.
Yeah. But yeah. Thank you, Sigourney Weaver. I'd be fascinated to know what he suggested as far as the behavior of the computer, because what we saw looked like it might have been, well, it clearly looks like it was written by some person who had no computer, no understanding of computers in any circumstances whatsoever.
Well, who did in 73?
Yeah, true. And try to come up with something. I mean, the idea of so much storage available on these little cylinders as tapes, I'm sure seemed like a very revolutionary idea to somebody in 1973. I mean, we look at that now and we laugh.
Yes. And don't forget the tapes that Devon pulled out of the computer that they were using in the Amish. Yes, microcassette recorder tapes. He was holding it up, and you could. In fact, at one point, the tape had spooled out, so you could see it. It was like, wow, that was probably they thought cutting edge because people were probably used to big cassette tapes. And
well, it was the first time I had ever seen a microcassette. I mean, I was
back
a kid
then,
at that time,
obviously.
But I had never seen one before at that time. I was able to identify it. I mean, I didn't have a name for it, but I was able to look at it and say, wow, that looks like a little mini cassette.
It's a...
far out. But I could see how somebody in 1973 might write that. It is laughable when we look at it today.
Anything else?
Well, it's pretty much it. I remember, again, this is so much like with Man from Atlantis. I remember when I watched it years ago, I really liked it. But then again, I didn't have anything else to watch as far as sci-fi was concerned. So it was satisfying a need that was desperate to be filled. Today, however, when I look at it, I thought, my God, this really is just terrible garbage. I remember when you came over, to our house for dinner, and you showed me the DVD, and I'm like, oh, cool. and I suppose from a
until you
geek
saw it.
Level, well, there's a certain geek aspect that it's still kind of tickles me in that area, only because it is just so god awful bad.
It is that
it deserves sort of an MST3K type treatment.
It is bad.
It's pretty horrible. So it kind of tickles the geek bone a little bit in that respect. But is this the kind of science fiction that I would rush out to watch because I thought it was of any quality? No way. This is crap. And the sad thing is, from what I remember, this is the best episode of the series.
That might be true. That might be true. I haven't even gotten through all of them yet. So
actually, there is one episode, and I remember I mentioned this to you. There is one episode that is later on that I really, really did enjoy. But I enjoyed it at the time when I watched it. And in fact, at that time, it became my favorite story. I think it was called Astromedics. I loved that episode, but as I was watching the episode just the other night, at one point I kind of thought back to Astromedics and thought, well, just as much as the scenario with this Amish type community and the way they've evolved, devolved, whatever, the fact that they exist in the state that they are is completely unbelievable. So with this story with Astromedics, the premise is, it seemed really great when I saw it at the time, but I'm sure if I were to watch it today in the cold light of day, it would look just as equally terrible.
Oh, I imagine so. I was just kind of looking through the episode guide to see what the Astromedics was about, and I happened to run across down the bottom that it looks like Garth does go back to Cypress Corners.
He does?
Well, it looks like it might have, or at least he decides to go back. I don't know if he does. That could be the...
That's right. I did read a treatment that he does decide to go back, but I didn't... I read something on that, but I don't remember. When did I read that?
We won't give it away because we still have 15 more episodes of Star Lost to review and ridicule, and the rest of them we won't even have to give any background on. We can just make fun of them and go.
Oh, okay. I will say this. Yes, he makes the decision to go back to Cypress Corners, but he doesn't.
Ah.
And that's all I'll say.
All right. Well, I think we have beat this poor show to death today.
Not nearly enough.
Not nearly enough, but we will have more episodes to beat it to death. I'm not sure. We won't just plow right into it next week. We'll go back to something else for our next episode. And I hope you all join us. I do want to remind you, if you are on Facebook, if you want to search us out and like our page, that would be great, even though there's not much on the page. Once we get a certain number of people, we can get a decent URL for it. But right now we're a few short of the required number. So I don't have a URL. You just have to search for Fusion Patrol. And until next time, this is Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
Hasta la vista.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol, or look for us on Facebook. Fusion Patrol is a production of Lone Locust Productions. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.